Hi, I'm Peter Medlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge from WNIJ. And if this is your first time hearing our show, good news. It's a really simple idea. We've all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today, and every educator we have on this podcast, whether teacher, coach, or professor, is nominated by the folks who listen. So we want you to be a part of this show with us. Please do. Tell us about the educators who've inspired you and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. You can email us with your nominations and your story ideas at teacherslounge@niu.edu. And on our show today, Colleen Guccione. She's a social studies teacher at Bolingbrook High School, and she's also a 2024 Illinois Teacher of the Year finalist. And I talk with Colleen about her career in education, where she's done everything from writing curriculum to developing an open enrollment AP course in human geography. And I'm especially fascinated about her human geography class, which she describes as the why of where instead of just the where you'd get in a typical geography class.
Kids will often say, like, this content's not hard, it's just that I've never thought about it before. So, like, what causes populations to increase and decrease is not something, and how does that affect, we see all these articles now about how that affects the economy if you have less workers. They've never had any reason to really think about a lot of those things, and so it's just mind-opening. Almost every unit, there's something where there's that aha moment of, gosh, I had never thought of that before, and then it keeps popping up. The curriculum definitely spirals, and that every unit is dependent on the unit before it.
All of that, her world travels, and the joys of Cincinnati, it's here on a brand new Teacher's Lounge. Before we get into that conversation, we have a few other education stories we want to share. The Re-entering Citizens Civics Education Act went into effect back in 2020, and it's meant to provide civics education to people in Illinois prisons before their release. And I got to report on how the program's going so far, especially in another election year. This March, during Illinois' primary election, Brian Beals voted for the first time since 1988. He'd spent 35 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit and was exonerated last December. And after being disenfranchised for so long, casting his ballot felt gratifying. And he was prepared, particularly because he'd spent his final few incarcerated years as a peer educator helping teach civics to other people in prison.
My credibility was on the line. Here I was in prison, you know, talking to guys about civic responsibility, and I finally, here it is, my time to actually get out and do it and back it up, put my money where my mouth was.
Beals was asked to be a peer mentor at the Dixon Correctional Center back in 2021. He'd been a peer educator for other programs previously, so he was a natural fit. And soon after, he was trained by representatives from Chicago Votes and the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. They're nonpartisan civics groups who helped develop the plan, and Cliff Helm is senior counsel with the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights.
At this point, we do monthly or near monthly peer educator training sessions.
He says those training sessions can include up to 40 people from a handful of different prisons. And since launch, they've trained over 250 peer educators like Beals. State reports show over 6,000 people have completed the program within a year of their release. And Chicago Votes says they've also received over 4,000 anonymous survey responses from folks in the course. Helm says the peer-led civics program includes three different courses that take 90 minutes each.
They cover the power of voting, which includes a conversation around the history of voting in the country and voting procedures as they've developed over the history of the country. Voting 101, so registration, you know, what does voting look like? What's a primary? And then government 101.
Beals remembers spending hours in a unit with two other peer educators preparing presentations. And his Dixon classes were small, sometimes only three people. And then he was transferred to the Robinson Correctional Center, where he was leading weekly classes with 20 students. His classes built a voting rights timeline and filled out sample registration forms. They talked about the impact of the war on drugs, and they discussed voting discrimination like poll taxes, and even had students take a Jim Crow voting literacy test.
No one ever passed it, just to show just how unfair and unjust the politics was back in the day, particularly surrounding minority black folks around the country.
Outside of the history of voting, Beal says it's also important to make sure incarcerated people know what their rights are today. He says many don't know that they can register to vote in Illinois immediately after their release.
I think generally across the population, there's a lot of misinformation. A lot of guys just didn't know.
It's particularly because those laws look very different from state to state. And through the program, they also hand out voting information handbooks to those leaving prison. Alex Boutros, program director at Chicago Vote, says not every Illinois facility offers the civics courses weekly as Robinson does.
Some institutions are doing weekly sessions. Some institutions will do them like ad hoc when needed, right? And a couple of institutions haven't even started.
The Department of Corrections releases an annual report detailing participation in the civics program at each facility, and the 2023 report shows only 11 of the state's 28 prisons had students enroll in and complete the peer-led civics courses. Shalandra Birch is the Assistant Chief of Programs for the Illinois Department of Corrections, and she says the numbers in her department's report don't fully reflect how many people actually enrolled or completed the course.
We do have the program established in all of our facilities. We were working on some updates as regards to our technical side and getting the data entered, and that caused just some of the data to look a little different.
A footnote in the report says numbers will be more accurate in future reports. The former peer educator Brian Beals says the civics course is one of the best programs running in the system right now, but not every peer educator has had as good an experience. Anthony McNeil was a peer educator for several years, most recently while incarcerated at the Centralia Correctional Center, and in March of 2023, he was teaching a course about Jim Crow poll taxes and literacy tests and how they were used to discriminate against Black voters. And then, according to a lawsuit filed by McNeil earlier this year, prison staff allegedly cut him off and told him not to talk about racism. The suit claims that after McNeil refused and told them it was a part of the curriculum, he was fired from teaching the civics course. Advocates including Boutros at Chicago Votes and Brian Beals support legislation to expand the civics program so it's not just limited to folks within a year of going home, but available to people as soon as they're incarcerated.
Just having that education in the beginning can actually change the way you do your time.
He says this knowledge can motivate people to invest in themselves and their education so they're in a better position to live, work, and once they get out, vote. And also, Northern Illinois teachers recently spent a week learning how to teach their students about water and their local watersheds, and it all culminated with a kayak ride down the Rock River, and I got to float down the river with my microphone to learn more.
We are officially out on the Rock.
A small group of teachers paddle south towards Rockford.
There's barely a cloud in the sky, a bunch of yaks on the water, feeling good.
This kayak trip was at the end of a free workshop from the University of Illinois Extension. The K-12 teachers soaked in lessons from local hydrologists, a geologist, and a soil specialist.
What you know about is what you take care of.
That's Peggy Annesy. She's an environmental educator with the U of I Extension who organized the watershed workshop. And teachers of all sorts took part, not just environmental educators. And because what you know about is what you take care of, the week started with a lesson on what a watershed even is. Annesy says you could think of a watershed like a bathtub. All of the water that falls into your watershed collects and eventually drains, like the tub drain in this simile, into a river, like the Rock, where we're kayaking right now.
So you have tiny watersheds that are in bigger watersheds, and eventually one-third of the U.S. drains into the Mississippi watershed. So the Mississippi literally drains a third of the United States, and that's our big watershed that we're in, and everything we put in it. From lawn care stuff to stuff down the drain, everything goes in your watershed.
You know, as I pull the microphone out, I really remember what a weird job I have sometimes.
Can I interest you in an on-the-river interview?
Chris Morofsa is a counselor at Hiawatha High School who's currently moving downstream alongside me.
It's almost like it changes your entire world.
He says he's learned so many things that are taken for granted.
There was a moment where we were in the water and looking at these macroinvertebrates and all of the larvae from caddisflies and all these things. And he's teaching us that these are bioindicators. These things are telling us the water's clean because they're able to live here. And I saw through his eyes that he's like, this is really clean water, and I'm happy about that.
As a counselor, he's probably not going to go back to school and do a water table activity with his students, but he wants to work with his fellow teachers to incorporate these resources and also tell his students about the career fields he learned about.
I advocate for so many things. That's what a school counselor does. I'm just going to add it to the list of things to advocate for. Let's care about our water. You live here too. Install some plants. That's all you got to do.
Jody Goodowitz is a science teacher at Sandwich Middle School.
From this week, I was just curious if there's things that you are particularly excited about taking with you
back into the classroom.
I really think like the connection between soil and water and like the kids understanding that connection, I think is huge. Because
at her old school, a group of her students planted native plants to help prevent flooding behind the building. And now she's building up her new school's STEM program and figuring out how to incorporate environmental science.
Where am I going to find this grant money to make these kids do this class, but then design a rain garden for our campus and then, you know, be able to actually implement this, you know, design that they've come up with.
Becky LeBoll is a fourth grade teacher in Samanok, and as she paddles, she's looking for examples along the water of best management practices and erosion, and she's thinking about the passion the experts showed this week and how she'll bring some of those lessons back to her elementary school students.
How do we take care of our water and our soil? All of those things are things you can take back into the classroom no matter what age you work with.
Luckily, a few of her colleagues are out on the water learning too, and all of the educators, no matter their grade level, are hoping to use what they've learned to teach their students how to see their community in a new way, to show them how connected they are to their local watershed and the positive impact they can make. All right, now it's time for my conversation with social studies educator and 2024 Illinois Teacher of the Year finalist, Colleen Guccione.
Well, the summer's become kind of interesting. So I'm here for a week, and then I go to AP grading, which I've been doing the last couple of years. So that's fun. So that's 10 days in Cincinnati scoring the AP Human Geography exam, which is basically scoring 8 hours a day and then going out with people that night. Which is fun, but it's a bit. I then, on some way that I'm not quite sure, I think from my nomination for Teacher of the Year, I'm then going to Shanghai for, now it's probably about 10, 15 days. I'm going to Beijing and Shanghai for our UNESCO Education Conference, which was not planned. And then I am going to Japan with 35 people from our building, mostly students, in July. So I haven't quite figured out how planning for next year is going to happen. I'm just kind of taking the summer day by day.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You're going global this summer. You're going to be all over the place. I mean, in Cincinnati too. That's amazing. Wow. That sounds like a pretty full summer on your plate.
Yeah. So that's enough that I'm just going to take it. Yeah. Everything's day by day right now, which is fine. I have a new class next year, but that class is going to involve making a lot of international connections. So this is my excuse to have to travel the world. So
yeah, it's good as any, right?
are you going to be able to do like much sightseeing, like all that type of stuff while you're there? I know you're there for conferences and stuff like that, but do you have an itinerary outside of that stuff you're trying to hit?
I'm getting the itinerary very slowly. The good news is they allow me to add on Beijing. So I'm going to go to Beijing and see kind of some of the classic sites there and go to the wall. And then in Shanghai, we get to go on school visits, which I'm super excited about. So we spend a whole day in schools. And then after, we have a series of educational conferences, but then we have 2 or 3 days of touring around Shanghai. So I'm super excited because I have never been, basically the farthest I've been in Asia is on the tip of Turkey, went on a cruise in Greece. So I'm looking forward to everything I can see.
I was going to ask if you had been in that part of the world before.
No, and ironically, I would have never thought they were both in the same summer, but I didn't say no. So it should be an interesting summer. And I literally come back from China and leave for Japan the same week with my students. So I'll have a really good comparison of China and Japan as a result. So,
yeah, what is the can you talk a little bit about the Japan trips? That's interesting, especially since that one's with your students. That's really cool.
Yeah, we do. We work with EF Tours, which is a national company. One thing I like about that program for us is that we allow kids to pay over 2 years. So Bolingbrook High School is not, you know, a high income community, but students have been able to take these opportunities because they have 2 years to pay a very small amount every month. And so we have about 30 kids going along with some chaperones and a couple of parents. And when I proposed this trip, actually, I was planning to go to Europe. And I threw Paris in there because it usually is something that kids want to do, but it was the Olympic summer and they're like, it's going to be super expensive. I'm like, well, my second choice is Japan. That's going to be more expensive. And it was only like $500 more. So I'm like, sure, let's do Japan. Well, I posted the posters expecting to get 5 or 6 kids to come. And I had probably 50 that were interested and then 30 that actually finally booked. So that one's all pre-programmed for us. We're going to Tokyo and Osaka and Hiroshima. And I'm super excited. And a lot of the kids are very much into anime, which I don't know much about. So I'm going to be learning a lot from them on the trip too.
So have you guys been able to do this over the past, like this is not the first time that you've done a trip like this with your students?
This will be my second one. I did one with a colleague to Greece and Italy a few years ago. And that's kind of what happened, is that kind of caused me to get the travel bug. I have three daughters of my own and they're all in college now. So I have the ability to do things in the summer. And I'm on a teacher salary, so I can't afford to travel like that in the summer without help. And so it's been life changing. I teach human geography. And so it's so much better to be able to teach kids having seen things than just read about it. And I just think it's great for any student to have that opportunity. And so many of our kids coming from abroad anyways, to also just kind of have the opportunities they have naturally growing up as an immigrant kid.
Yeah, it makes a ton of sense, especially like you said, with you as a human geography teacher, adding, you know, layers and layers onto that experience and bringing some of that definitely back into the classroom.
Yes, yes, it's awesome. So I hope to continue to do it for a long time.
Yeah, you know, Shanghai, Beijing, Tokyo, and Cincinnati, they do call the big four, you know, it's good.
That's right, that's right. You got to make sure Cincinnati's in there. It's our last year, the AP.
Queen City, that's
the,
right.
The exam next year, so I got to get it all in.
I'm curious about that before we get into the human geography and that stuff, but you are an AP grader. So like you said, like you're going to be spending like how long, like a week grading exams every day?
It's 7 days of exams grading. Plus you have an arrival day and a departure day. And it's very programmed. I think no matter what the exam is, you score. So, you know, breakfast ends at 8 and you are in your seat, or you can score at home, which is different now, but I score better there. Because I have no choice and you have to score. So you start at 8, you get your 15-minute break at either 10:15 or 10:30. And most people, they're usually in convention center. So almost the entire convention center empties because everyone wants to see sunlight and walks around the block. And then everyone comes back to their seats and does that again till lunchtime. And then again till dinner time. And then pretty much most nights people will go out. So Cincinnati, I knew nothing about, but it's been great. We usually will hit a Reds game one night. I hit a soccer game last year.
The
National Underground Railroad Museum is there and they're staying up late for us this year. So it's just, I mean, it's 400 people who teach the same thing that you do and have no responsibility for the week other than grading. And, you know, you're grading a couple hundred essays handwritten a day, more than a couple hundred. You need to not think much at night.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I think that when people,
I was just curious about what that grading process looks like. Because again, I think that people just, and again, it's going to be different, obviously, for grading essays versus grading other things. Like in our mind, we picture like these
great machines or like factories that are running through all this and grading. But it is something nice to me, at least, some reassuring that there are, you know, loads of teachers on the other end doing all this stuff. But that's,
yeah, so that's
how many a day do you think that you guys are grading then? Or like,
I usually,
like on
in the average week, I'll grade about anywhere from like 1,000 to 1,200. Over the week. And I would call myself a slow grader. I probably only grade 17 to 20 an hour. Some people can grade up to 23, 24 an hour.
I think that's a good thing. I think it's a good instinct to be slower. I mean, like, it's got to be like to try to stay focused and on top of it so that like you're giving as much due diligence to essay one as essay 897, because I have to imagine by 897 there's a part of your mind that's just like, oh my God,
I have been reading this so much, right? Because I imagine like
there's like a prompt, right? So like a lot of them are probably like, you know, they're exploring different ideas, but they're, you know, some topics are being covered multiple times. So by the time you hit the literally 900th essay you've read, I don't know how you do that.
They're all print. You kind of sometimes hope there's a joke in there or something else, but it's also super exciting if you get a really good essay. I mean, you sit in tables of about 12 and you're like, ours is worth 7 points if you get a perfect. And it's like, I got a 7. And everyone's always jealous if you manage to get a 7. And handwriting's always a crapshoot. And so you usually have a buddy next to you when you can't read something that is your break. You're like, okay, can you translate this? Or so it is, it's interesting. And it's high school and college teachers. So there's a whole lot of camaraderie and just also talking, you know, people want to be there. So it's a cool community to be part of.
It's like a Willy Wonka golden ticket thing, and you hand up and start waving around the 7 once they get it.
There is, you know, much candy and Diet Coke involved, or Diet Pepsi involved also. So that does help fuel everything also.
I can imagine. Do you, so like with that experience, I have to imagine, like, do you ever, like, to your students who are about ready to write it, like, have some advice, just like the, what, even as small as like what we said, like, put a joke in there. The people that are grading that might appreciate it.
Don't put a joke in there. It takes us longer to grade. Although I do appreciate them. We do compete over who can get the Taylor Swift lyrics too. Someone who's like, I don't have anything to write, so I'm going to tell you the lyrics of my song. No, it makes a huge difference in the classroom because I kind of know those little things that, I mean, we are still humans grading. So it's helpful to kind of know what people are looking for. You're back graded though. So, you know, for every 10 or 15, I'll read, the person who's in charge of my table will back read it to make sure that his score and my score are the same. And then they hide in the stacks, essentially, ones that have already been scored to make sure that you're matching. So it's very data driven with what you're doing too. So
that makes sense.
Yeah. There's a lot going on there, but yeah, it's an interesting week.
So again, you teach human geography, both human geography and AP human geography. I'm sure you get this question all the time, but for folks that don't know, is there a difference between just geography and human geography? Can you get into that a little bit?
There's a huge difference. I would never want to teach geography. Like back in the day, if you think about geography, it's, you know, here's a map of the world, memorize everything about it, the capitals, the locations of the mountains. The focus on human geography is very much human. So it's humans' interaction with the planet. So I think it's the best social studies course out there because I think it does a really good job of introducing a lot of other social studies. And also students constantly come back to me and say it relates to what they see in the world. So we do some basic geography. Our second unit is on population migration. So taking a look at populations and also how they change over time as they change over development levels, what kind of policies have to be enacted in order to help populations, you know, increase and decrease, especially nowadays with so many developed countries actually losing population. Our third unit is on culture. So that's always students' favorites because we get to go somewhat into religion, into architecture and languages. Our fourth unit is on political. Students often find that tough because they don't have quite the historical background that we might have had years ago because they don't come in with world history as freshmen. They're coming in right to this class. But students usually find that interesting. I've learned stuff since I joined the course. So, for example, we talk about the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Seas, which talks about international waters versus other waters. And I had never heard of it. And now that I teach the class, I notice it all the time. All the issues in China over the South China Sea has to do with that. We then do an agriculture unit, which kids think they're going to hate because I've got mostly suburban and city kids, but they actually usually end up really liking that unit. And then an urban unit. And then we end with industrialization and development. So it's just, it's in the news constantly. It's on NPR constantly, pretty much any story. And it's a course that tends to linger with kids and change your perspective on the world. And that part's really powerful as a teacher to get to be part of.
I think the way that I saw it described, I think the way that you described it maybe was that it's it explores the why of where, which I thought was really interesting. Again,
absolutely.
Like compared to regular geography, which is just the where, we got at least the why of where now.
Yeah. Yes. And very much how the where influences the why, but also how the why influences the where. So I've taught lots of, I've been in education for 30 years, so I've taught lots of courses, but this by far is my favorite.
Really? By far your favorite?
I like interdisciplinary teaching. So my second favorite course, which would have been my favorite before this, is American Studies, where you teach U.S. history and American lit with a English teacher. And I think that for me, that's just the natural way of learning is not really siloed. And so both of the classes that have been my favorites over the years have been ones that look beyond a single subject.
Right. Well, I think it's interesting, too, that this class is divided up in units by theme and topic and not divided out by region is interesting.
Very much. So we definitely, in that first unit on geography, we set up the regions to start so that we can refer
sure.
to them throughout the year. But that is a big change from traditional geography classes. And it helps break the mold so that you're not just in one region.
Are there particular, you mentioned that agriculture is one of them that students coming in don't think it's going to be something that piques their interest as much, but it does end up doing that. Are there particular either units, projects, things like that you look forward to because you know it's going to be something that is going to be especially like hooking people that maybe might not be as interested or might not think that they're as interested going in?
I think content-wise, the agriculture unit, they have so little background that it's really interesting for them to kind of see how much climate plays a part in agriculture that they haven't really thought about, that it's not just random where things are grown, but it's very much, it seems simple, but on the global scale to see that. I think in our development unit, probably their favorite game of the year is we play a game that has, it's called the World Trade Game, and they essentially make shapes out of paper and they have to trade them. But they're, one of the theories of geography is something called Wallerstein's World Systems Theory, that there's core countries, there's periphery countries, and there's semi-periphery countries. Well, they don't know it, but their envelopes for their materials for their countries are very much based on what level of development they're at. And kind of seeing that it's not just about working, you know, it's not whether or not you're working hard as to whether or not you're advanced, I think is a really important lesson for them to know. Population, it's just, I think a lot of this stuff, it's not that they can't figure out, the kids will often say like, this content's not hard, it's just that I've never thought about it before. So like, what causes populations to increase and decrease is not something, and how does that affect, we see all these articles now about how that affects the economy if you have less workers. They've never had any reason to really think about a lot of those things. And so it's just mind opening. Almost every unit, there's something where there's that aha moment of, gosh, I had never thought of that before. And then it keeps popping up. The curriculum definitely spirals, and that every unit is dependent on the unit before it.
Right. So we're just building and building and building throughout the course of the year then. It's and you've been teaching this class for 7-ish years now?
7 years, yes. So when I came to the school, I was one of the people that they were starting the program here. And unlike a lot of schools, we accept. So we have about a third of our freshman class. So I think this year we had about 300 kids take AP Human Geography. And so we've worked hard as a team to kind of support kids across our classes, whether or not we have them, because we have most of our kids are reading around grade level. Some are reading super high. But unlike a traditional AP class where you might have only the very top of the class, we have kids reading at grade level who are successful in the class.
Right. And that seemed like that was, from what I was reading, that was one of the reasons that you came to the district, was to try to, you know, helping establish that open enrollment AP class.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's always kind of been my thing when I taught. I've taught on and off over the years, but when I taught at Lyons Township, the American Studies program that we started had been already in LT for years, but it had been, again, an honors program. And our version of the program was sort of the bottom third of the class, because I think that if you spiral things correctly and give kids support, most kids can learn most things. And that's been true kind of throughout my career.
Yeah. Do you feel like now that you've had, you know, that 6-7 years or so you've been teaching this class, do you feel like, obviously the world evolves a lot, right? Like even the world vastly different, obviously, from now than it was in 2017. You grow, you do this class over years. Do you feel like, does the course evolve over time? Like from not even necessarily the curriculum, but the way that you teach it in 2017 versus what it looks like now?
Yes and no, because it's an AP course when it comes to the AP classes, everything's dependent on the AP exam. So sure. That evolved because they changed the CED, the curriculum that they follow. That caused it to change. I think the examples that we give students are very much, we try to make it as relation to the world as we can. So the examples are very topical and very current day. At the same point, the AP exam is never, pretty much guarantees for human geography, it won't have anything current on it or in the last year, partially because of printing and everything else. So like, right. I think this is the first year there might've been some COVID. There's definitely nothing on Israel and Palestine on the exam, unless it's something from, you know, far in the past. And so that is one weird thing about this class, is all of this relates to the world, but then we don't get to spend as much time as I'd love on the current events because we're gearing up for this AP test. Now in our non-AP class, we will spend some more time on current events and making those connections. But in AP, we don't spend as much of it. Now, kids will come up and talk to me after class, but it's not fully part of the curriculum. The irony is the first couple of years we taught this class, kids didn't know what the word pandemic meant. It was a vocab word that I would have to work on regularly with them. And obviously now it's not. And actually in my on-level human geography class, the year of COVID, we actually started tracking the Johns Hopkins map on COVID outbreaks starting in January, because I had heard about it. And it was an easy way to also teach kids geography on our co-taught courses. So we had been tracking it since January. So by the time March hit and we were gonna, you know, have a couple of days off of school, I'm like, we're not coming back. And everyone's like, yes, we are. And I'm like, you can ask anyone in my first hour, we've been tracking this since January, we're not coming back. So it has been fun to see how much it connects. And the non-AP class gives me more opportunity to do some of that.
That had to be a weird experience tracking that in real time with the class, because in one hand, just when you're tracking things like that and you see the growth and you're like, oh, that's really interesting, like the class is going to find that. But then you're also like, oh, wait, that's actually really bad. Like, we don't want that to be happening. That had to be odd to watch play out with them.
I was so impressed with all the conclusions they kind of came to, though, before any of us really knew they were conclusions. So it was a really powerful teaching moment, because like my boss would come in, other people would come in, and I'm like, ask these guys anything. I know these aren't our AP kids, but trust me, they're experts at this point, because it was so fascinating to watch.
That's so interesting. And it's cool that the non-AP course, you get a little bit of the opportunity to be a little bit more topical when you're not strictly bound to what the test is going to be there.
Exactly. And that is nice.
And I saw too that like one of the reasons that it kind of coming in to do this AP human geography class was interesting to you, or something that you wanted to do, was because of your background, I think, that we mentioned, of writing curriculum. And I was really fascinated to talk to you about this, because I think you spent a couple years just like solely working on curriculum development, right?
Correct. So basically, I have taught for 7 years. We were having our second child. My husband was also teaching, and the whole who's going to take off for, you know, when the kid's sick with the sub was not going well. So when I had the second kid, I had the opportunity to work for a company that I love called Teachers Curriculum Institute. I was using their stuff in the classroom anyways. And so they had this, hey, join us as a part-time position, which turned into very much not a part-time position. And so it started by writing like tips for teachers when it came to diverse learners. And then it eventually turned into, we wrote the geography program and the US history program. And it was fascinating as a teacher to be involved on the other side of it. So like at that time, understanding by design and kind of backwards design was kind of new. So that was where I really got into it. We were writing national curriculum. So, you know, I was watching the California standards and the New York standards, which are really picky. The Illinois standards were pretty easy to hit. And then you would work on, like, we literally outlined the chapter for the author. We made all the handouts for the teachers. We figured out the activity. You would have to meet with some sort of professor in the subject area who checked everything. And then every one of our lessons was also tested in the classroom. So it was a fascinating process.
That is, I really wanted to ask you, I'm glad that you started diving into it there. Because again, I think that curriculum, especially, you know, obviously like teachers are familiar, we all know generally what curriculum is, but in some ways it kind of does feel like, and I guess I'll just speak for myself, and I know there's parents, that it could feel like a black box sometime, where you're like, we've got this curriculum, but we don't often get the peek behind the scenes of how these things are developed, what that process, like you were just explaining, actually looks like. And it's something that I, you know, just as a someone who covers education and is very interested in education, always wanted to dive more in detail on, because it is, like you said, broadly, it's this big puzzle that you're putting together. But also, there are so many details in each specific step. And like you said, you're going through different state standards and meeting with there's a lot that goes into it that I think people don't always get the chance to really explore.
Yeah, and I love being creative. I love curriculum. I went on after that to, I did some online programs. I work for a company that essentially worked for the Ohio State Department of Education and wrote a lot of their online curriculums for a lot of the social studies program. But what brought me back to the classroom when I could make it work with my home life was I like being with the kids, and I like to create the lessons, but I also like to see how they work. And so for me, as much as I could probably write curriculum for the rest of my life and like it, it's not the same as the high I get in the classroom.
Yeah, that totally makes sense. You're in the classroom, you leave, and you do have this experience writing curriculum. Then you come back in the classroom. Does having that, again, like you've seen the Wizard of Oz behind, you've seen the man behind the curtain a little bit, did that impact as you went back into the classroom, either how you approached things or how you thought about things, knowing how the sausage is made in that way?
I think I've always been interested in curriculum, even as an undergrad. So
sure.
It wasn't completely new, but like now I can often explain to my colleagues the why, like, well, why is this in here? I'm like, well, that has to do with the New York State standard or something else. So I think that helped. I think knowing too that when I was in college, I was pre-law. So there was always still I could be making a lot more money. But if I stayed in education, the other two other things I had considered was full-time curriculum writing and being head of a library in a school. And one of the other jobs I had when I was home with kids was being an assistant for 3 years in an elementary school library. So I feel like I got my other gigs out of my system and was like, no, you really like high school students and you want to go back to that. So I think that more than anything else made a difference, is I knew that this is where I wanted to be. And as I watch colleagues who've taught all the way through, I think sometimes I'm calmer about knowing I want to be here till the end, because I've done other things and I like being here. I think it also helps. I've been at multiple schools, and so I come in with that perspective. My kids go to a different schools where I teach, and all those perspectives just, I think, make you a better teacher no matter what you're doing.
Yeah. You mentioned that when you were an undergrad, you were for pre-law. So there was a couple different tracks that were available to you, the education or the law route or curriculum writing. We do always want to dive into kind of the teacher origin story, as it were, for folks, because we have plenty of people who, you know, were elementary school kids and they were setting up stuffed animals in their bedrooms and teaching them and doing that whole thing. There are plenty of people that come to it much later in their life, either through a career change or when they're in college. I'm curious, for you, is teaching something that you were at least interested in from an early age, or was it something that really became tangible for you later on?
I think it was always there. I mean, my family's full of teachers, so I think part of it. My mom taught elementary school. My dad was a guidance counselor. Her brother was taught at University of Michigan. So it was always kind of there. And my brother's in computer science. He will not do it. And he has a much larger house than I do. So I think I always knew I wanted to be possibly in education. But it wasn't until high school that I kind of figured out that this would be where I'd want to be. So as much as I think, I did teach my stuffed animals some, and one of my best friends when I was in elementary school moved to California, and we would send each other worksheets that we would make back in the day.
Really? What are we covering on those worksheets? What are we talking?
Lots of simple math. 3 + 2. But then we would send it back graded. Obviously, this is before you had any other way to send things. But we probably did that for a couple of years. But I think high school is where I kind of found myself. And so I think that was a focus. I always liked law, and I did the full pre-law track. I was a history major. But I never did end up taking the LSAT. I kind of knew that at least I had to try this education thing first. And then I could always go back and do law if it didn't work out. But I needed to get the education bug out of my system. And that concept of flow, I mean that honestly, when I'm in the classroom or if I'm designing interesting lessons, I get into that state of flow, and I haven't been willing to give that up yet.
You don't have, now that you're teaching all the maritime law stuff, now you're thinking maybe I can be a marine lawyer. That could be your third act.
Even if I went into law, even when I was considering strongly to go into law school, it would have still been educational based. I think that was the clue. I was interested in all the Supreme Court cases that had to do with education. So I think that no matter what, I probably would have been in the field somewhere. And like I said, money-wise, I still doubt it sometimes, but I'm here now. My plan is to stay.
So both your parents were in education. That sometimes that can go either way, right? Sometimes you can either be like, oh yeah, my mom was a teacher, so of course I want to be a teacher too. I want to be just like her. Or for some people, it could be like, I saw how stressed out she was. I want no part of that.
No way, none of them.
So were they in any, you said your dad worked in education too as a guidance counselor. So when you were in high school or college and really being voicing, I think that education is something that I want to pursue, were they heck yeah, that totally makes sense? Or were they a little surprised?
I'm giving away the family secret now. So they were all for me going into education, but they would not pay for my education if I went into special ed for whatever reason. I'd worked in special ed even in high school. I'd worked at a lot of the special recreation summer camps. And so my theory was always either I go to a school where I get a scholarship if I wanted to go into special ed. I was looking at Trinity in Texas, or I could always add that endorsement on later on. Now, ironically, I still don't have my special education endorsement, but like I said, I tend to teach as part of my day always some of our lowest students anyways. So I've kind of seemed like I've gotten to it another way.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought I saw that you had done some special education teaching in the past as well too, right?
Yeah, for the last couple of years at least, I've co-taught I do co-teaching. So I teach with a special education teacher and we have the class together. So I think I'm always still there. I think they were concerned that I'd be in special education all day, and they knew that that was a tough career from seeing what they had seen. And so I've just kind of gone about it different ways.
Yeah. So you knew that you had, from a pretty early age, that you had this itch for education. Obviously, you know, we always like to ask people about, like, if, you know, since this show is based on the idea kind of that everyone has had a teacher that has inspired them or helped them become who they are today, I was curious to ask you if there were folks from anywhere along your education journey, whether it be, you know, a second grade teacher or whether it be a college professor or even a colleague that you work with now, who is someone that inspired you or helped you kind of feel like you get to where you're at today. But you've also got the family component too, where you, so you also give a shout out to mom and dad too.
They definitely made it okay to go into education. I'm not that true that that's true for every family, that they're okay with people going into education. I think, like I said, because I found myself in high school, kind of two of my big influences. One was a history teacher I had freshman year for world history and senior year for AP European history. He was this tall Russian guy, Dr. Prochaska. And he literally started the first day of class because he is like over 6 feet, and he would climb on the desk and he would direct class from up there. And, you know, you're freshman, you had no clue what was going on. And at the end of the day, he'd be like, okay, now write about it. And then we looked at the historical analysis of what everyone had said about the day before. It was brilliant. And so he was a fascinating guy. He had a ton of background in Russian history. And I went to high school still during the Cold War. And so I think he was just a really good teacher about both. Some teachers are strong in content and some teachers are strong in teaching. And I think he was one of those people that was strong in both. My student council advisor, Mr. Schroeder, he was good about recognizing students as individuals. And so I think, and he gave teenagers a whole ton of power to do lots of different things. And I think that made a difference to me. Teaching wise, when I worked at Teachers Curriculum Institute, that company in California, the publishing company, Steve Seeley was one of the other teachers like me that was writing curriculum. He's a little bit older than I was, teaches in Sacramento. And he just ran his class differently than I had ever heard of. He, you know, didn't, before it was the thing to do, he didn't give his kids a whole lot of notes. They didn't take a whole lot of notes. There was a lot of discussion, yet I knew he had really high AP scores. And he was someone that I definitely tried to model and tried to learn from a lot when I was at Teachers Curriculum Institute. So he's someone that today still kind of influences a lot of my teaching.
Yeah. Well, it's so interesting that you talk about, like, modeling yourself after, and some people being strong in some things, strong in others, and the teachers that inspired you come from very different, you know, subjects too, right? And it makes sense given that, you know, through your career, you have, especially in K through 12 education, I feel like a lot of times people are on one track and they teach one thing, and oftentimes they teach it at one school for a very long time. But you've had a really unique perspective in that you have gotten to, like you said, scratch a lot of different itches around education. It's a really cool thing that you've been able to really bounce around and try to satisfy all these different curiosities that you had in education, which is not something that I feel like I see a ton.
Yeah, I'm very grateful. I have no regrets with how things happen. Because I think all those, I was a elementary school assistant for 3 years before I was a library assistant. And the most fascinating part in that time was, here I was, a teacher with, you know, 8 years experience watching teachers teach all day. I mean, I was assisting the kids, but really I'm observing every day. And so there's a teacher there, Julie, I don't remember her last name. She had the best classroom management. She taught first grade of anyone I'd ever seen. And there's some tips that I took from her too. So it would, to have that ability after you start teaching to do those kind of things, you know, I feel very lucky.
I still feel like, and I don't know what your plans for the future are, but I can picture in my mind that we're going to have another conversation like this, Colleen, in 8 years, and you're going to be teaching like AP chemistry or something.
You know what I mean? Like,
chemistry, maybe. Physics, no way. So.
And, you know, one of the last questions, Colleen, that we always like to kind of end on, I'll pose it two different ways. I'll do one that's specific to human geography and one that's more specific, like broadly to education in general. But we always like to ask if there's something that you think is more important than people might realize, or you just wish more people knew about. So when it comes to human geography and the themes and topics that you guys cover in that class, is there something that you just think is more important than people might realize when they read those words, human geography, and make their assumptions about what your class covers.
For today's generation of kids, realizing how global their world is going to be, I think is hugely important. And this idea that we can teach subjects in a cylinder and that we can, you know, just focus on the United States is not the world that these kids are entering. They're already not in it. And so the more opportunities we can have across classes to give kids that global perspective is so key. And not to promote another program, it's not chemistry, but we're starting here next year, the Illinois Global Scholars Program, which allows kids to do inquiry-based research on any place in the world. And they have to have two on-the-ground sources, including someone from not in the United States. And I think that's where I see people need to have more opportunities for kids to do, is to have that global perspective. Because whether you're working at the gas station down the street or you're working at some, you know, transnational corporation, you're going to be impacted by things that don't happen anywhere close to you.
Yeah, and you know, it's something that for years we've heard in education, right? People, teachers will say, like, this is a global world that you're going into. And I think that every year that goes by, it gets more and more apparent to those students, right? Like, even when I was in high school 10, 15 years ago, that seemed a little bit abstract in some ways, that it was a global world, right? Like, there was some social media, but it's not like I was seeking out, you know, conversations with people that, you know, lived in Croatia or anywhere else. But now it is so easy, and you do see so many perspectives all the time, whether you're scrolling through TikTok or whether you're anywhere else, right? Like, it is just so much easier to have a perspective of people across the globe than it was 5-10 years ago, even.
Right. Yeah. And so much of our economy is based on things that are international. You saw that when you saw all the shipping chain backups, supply chain backups that happened during COVID. It's not that everything's being made in your town. So having more understanding of that does make a difference. And so for me, that's the power of human geography, is it gets kids thinking about the world in multiple ways too.
And then, is there something about education in general or being a teacher that you wish more people knew about?
So many choices there. I think about the professionalism of the education world. You know, we just had Teacher Appreciation Week, and everyone always jokes that if you get a week of appreciation, you're not paid enough. But I do have a lot of friends who aren't in education. You know, and I watch a friend of mine who she does professional development, and, you know, she has a week or two to prepare, you know, 1 or 2 hour session at thousands of dollars an hour. And, you know, I'm popping out 5 presentations a day. And I think the value of a strong education is going to be even more crucial in the future as we try to, as we have more technology, but need to find how to use that technology. And I think the importance of teachers is going to continue to remain to be strong, even as we have these changes when it comes to AI and other things.
Absolutely. And also a great reminder for me to set up a Journalist Appreciation Week sometime soon here.
Yeah.
Public Radio Journalist Appreciation.
Got your tote bag? Is that not enough?
That's true. Yeah, I've got my tote bag and I've got my book light and I'm good to go. But the last question, I'm curious, as we end off on, we're headed into the summer. You're doing a lot of travel. It's going to be warm in a lot of places. Colleen, I saw that you are always on the quest to find the best ice cream shops. I got to ask, I know this is something that can fluctuate a lot depending on, you know, your over time, depending on your mood even, but what are your go-to ice cream flavors right now?
Ice cream flavors? If I have to pick the everyday one, it's going to be mint Oreo every time, because mint just usually goes well with Oreo. I always like something in it. I do like a good, if you're thinking Ben and Jerry's flavor, like a Chunky Monkey. So I'm always willing to try the local version of a Chunky Monkey with banana and chocolate and nuts. And then I'm always up for the local one. Like, when, if I go to those shops, I'm often the one that's trying the, you know, Dort County Cherry, or the, like I wrote in one essay, there's Play-Doh ice cream at Cool Creations in Lockport. And like, I just want to try the weird ones just to see what they're like. So I'm very happy post-COVID that you get your taster spoon back, because I don't necessarily want a whole scoop of it, but I do like to try whatever the weird local flavor is.
See, that's advice just for life too, right? Try the weird local flavors when you get the chance to, just in general.
Absolutely.
That was Bolingbrook High School Social Studies Educator and 2024 Illinois Teacher of the Year finalist,
Colleen Guccione. Thanks so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. And as always, feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our great guests. Please send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. Keep sending your story ideas as well so we can keep bringing you the best education coverage possible. And wherever you're hearing the show, please do subscribe, leave us a rating, share, whatever you can do. It's the best way to get even more ears on the show and even more perspectives on the show. You can subscribe to the Teacher's Lounge newsletter over at WNIJ.org to keep up to date with everything we've got going on in the show. Big thanks to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear throughout every episode of this show. I've been your host, Peter Mudlin, and we'll be back with more Teacher's Lounge very soon. See ya.